This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. In the aftermath of the Kyle Plush tragedy, a sense of urgency to do something to fix the 911 system pervades City Hall. Although legal processes delayed the release of the report this week, the acting city manager presented an outline of a reform plan. After the turmoil that has engulfed City Council for 2 months, members were hoping for a period of calm, focused work. But the personal finances of newly elected council member Jeff Pastor raises uncomfortable questions, and the revelation that the administration picked a lock at the park board without its knowledge just keeps the pot stirred. To probe developments at City Hall, we are joined by Cincinnati Enquirer City Hall reporter Sharon Coolidge, Cincinnati Enquirer political columnist Jason Williams, and WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi there.
Gee, some interesting things here. So what is this, Jay, what's the status of the report that they were hoping to get last week, then got held up by the prosecutor's office? Where are we on this?
Well, Vice Mayor Smitherman tweeted out this morning that the prosecutor has now returned that file back to the police department, and the Law and Public Safety Committee at its regular meeting on May the 14th will now receive that report that they were supposed to get this week.
So does that mean the report won't be released until May 14th?
That was my assumption, that it would not be released until it came out at this committee meeting.
I have confirmed that, because it does seem like it is complete and it would be a public record at this moment, but the city is not planning on releasing it.
So where did the sense of urgency go on getting this thing out and getting something rolling on reform here?
I think they feel like they have already really launched these reforms with the big 911 plan that we heard about on Monday, although that seems like a very long time ago now. And, you know, the things that we've heard from the chief so far doesn't suggest anything
that we don't already know.
Well, there's lots we don't know, but I don't think that they think that there is an urgency.
Okay.
I think the Enquirer was at Monday or Wednesday. I think it was Wednesday when this was supposed to be released. I think it was like five questions that have yet to be answered. Those questions are still out there. I'm not sure what happened to the sense of urgency. I mean, we were told that as soon as this report was out and ready to go, once it was presented to the Plush family, the hearing would be set and it would be made public. Now there's, 10-day delay?
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about that plan that was released earlier this week. And what is it that, Sharon, what is it that strikes you about the plan? This is coming from the manager's office, Patrick Dehaney. And
Dehaney.
So,
Dehaney?
Dehaney. Thank you.
A lot of people, I've had so many people ask me how to pronounce it, so.
Yeah. I haven't met him yet, so he's not real to me yet.
The plan, it is so comprehensive. The most striking thing to me in it, it's many, many parts. Every single part has a completion date attached to it, an aggressive completion date. And as a citizen, I want to look at those dates and I am like, that is great, because I want that to be fixed by then. As someone who's covered City Hall for a while now, I'm a little bit like, that is super aggressive. And that would be like the fastest the city's moved on anything that it's ever done. But they're planning weekly updates. They're going to hold people accountable to these dates. 30 dispatchers and operators within this year. And that is such a high number, and it is what we need. And so they were willing to write it down on a piece of paper, say everything we need, and say, I'm going to have this fixed by this date.
Has this been approved by council yet?
I don't think there was really an approval. I think it was a report. Most of it can be handled internally without – there might be some funding things that will be included in the upcoming budget, but I don't think there was anything per se that council had to approve this. They're calling it an action plan. But what Sherry was talking about, the strict timelines and being able to follow along, the previous administration launched a lot of focus on analytics. And there's actually going to be a dashboard on the city's website, right, with the different components of this plan, and you'll be able to follow along with their progress.
I'm planning on keeping it up and just like the side screen at all times.
Well, I think it is. My reaction to it is, with those completion dates, targets, looking for best practices in other cities. This strikes me as a very business-like plan. And it's the sort of thing that people can be held responsible for. And in a sense, that in itself is a little bit of an answer to what the mood was with Harry Black, feeling that things got recommended, but nothing ever seemed to happen.
Right. And so this is a level of counsel knowing what's going on at all times. And so it'll be interesting to see, like, what else we see that kind of oversight for going forward.
And Councilmember Landsman has said he wants this discussed every week at the council meeting, which when I first heard that, I thought, yeah, that's good to say, but I don't see it happening. But I think it's going to happen. It happened this past Wednesday. He even led the acting city manager into it. He said, I'm looking forward to hearing what the city manager has to tell us about the plan so far.
And they already had a very substantial meeting with the county that was outlined. So it's actually, they did something this week for that update, and it showed that there was already progress.
And clearly this plan, I think, has to work because the ECC has had problems probably for decades.
Agreed.
And they've tried it, you know, with police and fire supervision. They took it to civilian supervision. Now it's back to police and fire. There are still issues, and I think they're to the breaking point. Something has to change.
Let's move on to talking about the news about Jeff Pastor. And Jason, what's sort of the outline of what the issues are here? What was revealed?
So Sharon broke the story this week that it was early. It was two things: that a wealthy benefactor who happens to be Jeff Pastor's boss in his day job at a epilepsy foundation, Charlie Shore, purchased a $550,000 home, or took out two loans, $500,000 and a $50,000 loan or mortgage for Jeff Pastor to buy a house in North Avondale, very nice house. And at the same – so that was last week. And then this week, we obtained an email in which Charlie Shore, you know, potentially separately – I mean, we don't know if these are directly related. So, but it gives off the potential conflict is that he has issues with his flooding basement and has had that for a long time, and has been battling the city-run Metropolitan Sewer District for a while. Well, he sent an email to City Manager Harry Black's assistant back in January, and in that email said he discussed that he had $1 million worth of problems with his basement, said that Jeff Pastor advised him to reach out to the city manager and asked for it to be resolved quickly.
Sharon, what put you onto this story? What led you to this situation?
It really bubbled up on social media. That's today's world. People were questioning how Jeff Pastor, who, you know, really campaigned on, he talked a lot about being a substitute teacher. He works in schools. That's kind of was his narrative during the campaign. And people were asking on social, how could he afford a $500,000 house? And it is a lovely house. I really took a close look at that. And I was like, well, I don't know. What are we going to write about this? There's a lot of like sub issues on it. And I kind of set it aside. I didn't really see, like, maybe his boss did buy him. There, people do private loans with people in their lives all the time. That's not that unusual. He is a public figure, so it bears some scrutiny. But it's this email, and Jason obtained this email, and it really tied it together, and it needs more scrutiny than it's even gotten so far.
A couple of things. I went back to Pastor's website during the campaign. There is no mention of this job on the website.
I've seen that too.
And just absolutely nothing there. The substitute teacher thing, the King Academy community school teaching is mentioned. Those seem to be the job things that he was doing. So it is strange that just a few months ago, he wasn't even recognizing a job that apparently pays in six figures.
He told me that, yes.
So that's significant. Jason, on the other hand, the fact that a council member is approached by somebody who says, I have a problem, and the council member's response is,
best way to deal with that is to reach out to the city manager's office. That doesn't strike me as a problem. I think that's a frequent answer that council people give. There's somebody who can actually do something. I can't do it, but just do it. So I don't see any problem with that if that's all that's involved.
Exactly. And I mean, you make a good point, Dan. I would think if anyone called Jeff Passer's office asking for help with a flooded basement, he would say, hey, that's an administration thing. You might want to reach out to the city manager's office. Certainly that is not, that's probably a pretty standard thing. However, there's been nothing, he's done nothing illegal here there's been no proof of that. There's been no proof that he's done anything unethical. But just the simple fact that there's red flags that are raised here. When you are a public official, you are under the microscope. And when you accept a $550,000 house, you are going to be questioned about it.
I think, didn't you point out that the city's own ethics rules for their employees, even the potential of a conflict of interest should raise a red flag with city employees?
Yep. And Sherry told me that I use this in my column that she found out that technically that code of ethics is just for city non-elected employees. Now, the elected employee or the elected officials of City Hall are subject to the Ohio Ethics Commission, standard of ethics, which are the language is very similar to the city's.
Well, here's what I want to ask about that. Here's a young person who's never held public office before. First time that he ran. It's not even that he had run in the past and not gotten elected. He hasn't been around elected office before. When a new person comes into office like that, what sort of orientation does he get? Who provides it? What sort of, how do you walk in and know what the rules are here?
I'll take a crack at it. I think that the city solicitor's office sits down and walks through ethics training with any new council member.
Okay.
So he should have had, I would hope, prior to even being sworn in, gone through the ethics process.
You know what? Maybe they didn't do it this year since the five people were talking together in text. Is that a possibility? I'm just kidding.
I mean, is it also
touche?
Is it part of that also to go over public records and public meetings laws as well?
I would assume. They don't do a refresher course with the
right, and they wouldn't need it. I mean,
there would be two of those that would have been new, and they also had to do an ethics filing either in February or I think it was due by the end of March. So they should have been through the process of doing the ethics filing that is required by the state.
So where does this go from here? I mean, you've raised the question, who is obligated or not obligated to respond?
Well, the Ohio Ethics Commission, they do not comment on any ongoing investigation, which you could see why, because they don't want to taint anybody or have it be used in political campaigns. I mean, it's such a sensitive area. But they couldn't have been more clear. They're like, we investigate things when we get complaints. Sometimes we investigate things just on our own.
There are some lingering questions out there as well from the campaign with Jeff Passer. Give him credit for someone who wasn't involved in politics, really. I mean, he used to work for the Ohio Republican Party in Columbus, but around here he wasn't really involved in politics. Comes out of nowhere. Works really hard, develops all these relationships, and as a first time candidate who no one knew about won. I mean, you got to give him credit for that. Now, there are some red flags. He gave himself a $54,000 loan during the campaign, and at the time, we knew from his bio that he was a school resource officer. We did not know at that time that he was executive director of a foundation making six figures. But he used a super PAC, which is I'm not sure a super PAC has ever been used before in a city election. Now, John Cranley has a PAC. It's a leadership PAC. Both are, subject to federal, elections, laws. But it was very, it raises some red flags, and certainly it's worth questioning.
Yep. So the ethics committee Ethics Commission for the state of Ohio would probably be the official body that would pursue
it
this.
It would be up to them. And there's no way to know.
And there's no way to know whether it's
I mean, you have, of course, heard about investigations like this. Every once in a while when somebody files, they publicly say, I filed, and say what they do, which they can do. But we haven't heard that in this.
Sherry, you had a story in this morning's paper about
This is my favorite one of the week.
That's right.
Of the day.
Well, you know, it's Friday. Need a little smile. That the administration apparently back in January?
Yeah, in February.
February. Sent some people over to the park board after hours with a locksmith to pick a lock on a closet. What's going on here?
You know, this one was it was odd. And it came to my attention through somebody anonymously sharing the bill for going to, it's the Bettman Nature Preserve, lovely place, by the way. And they keep a bunch of files in the basement, apparently. And somebody brought to my attention that there was a bill that Deputy City Solicitor Terry Nestor had a locksmith come out there after hours. And
so somebody sent you this bill, a copy of the bill?
Yeah, but it was a very specific bill. God bless the person who wrote the bill out. Okay. We got called there after hours. You know, we picked the lock of the basement. Then we went inside. We picked the lock of files. Then we relocked them, and then we left.
Now, this is happening in the midst of a lot of tension between the mayor and the park board, the administration and the park board. How do you put that in the context of is it – you don't really know what they were looking for exactly, but is it about recent things, or do you think this is old news that they're going back after?
Nobody from the administration did talk to me and say what they were looking for, but some people who had been briefed about what they were looking for were willing to tell me as sources, that they were looking for information about Willie Carden and Mary Jane Klug, two parks employees that the administration did not always get along with because of disagreements over how the parks and the Parks Foundation should be run. There's longstanding animosity there, and they were looking for things related to them, but I don't have that confirmed from the administration, so I don't know exactly what they were looking for. Now, there certainly were files in that basement, but they were old payroll files.
And what I can't wrap my mind around is what we're talking about is public records. And city administration officials should have access to public records during working hours without having to hire a locksmith to go to a closet and unlock it to go through
payroll records. So what does that tell you, Jay?
I'm assuming that there was probably, and this is my assumption, I'm putting that right out front. I'm assuming that there were a select number of keys to this closet, and those being investigated probably had the keys to the closet, and the city and the folks who wanted this information didn't want the folks who had the keys to know they were going through their closet.
And, you know, one park board member sent an email after the story ran, and he raised a lot of questions. He was very upset that the park board had not been – that was one key of this. Like the park, they just didn't ever tell anybody. I mean, they didn't find a lot of things, but then they never said – and that is how the bill came to parks by accident. It hadn't been paid. There was a follow-up, like, why aren't you paying the bill?
The bill went to the park board
first, and they were what is this?
Yes, you have to pay us for breaking into your closet.
And then that's how they kind of sorted out that it was like, well, whose name is on the bill? And then that's how it came to everyone's attention, then it was brought to my attention. And so that's why there was like a delay. The park board was never told.
This is almost one of those things you can't make up, because I can almost picture Terry Nestor in dark sunglasses and a trench coat and leather gloves getting ready to go into this closet to go through payroll boxes.
Because it was winter, it was dark outside.
Well, it just becomes one more piece in this struggle between City Hall, both the administration and the mayor's office, and the park board, which is autonomous, independent. How do you describe exactly what that relationship is on a legal basis? This has got, if you got a response from a member of the park board, given what's happened over the last, couple years, but especially in the last 6 months, this does nothing to heal the relationship, this sort of revelation.
Well, I think we're probably going down a path of a little better relationship. I mean, this park board member is a holdover from before. The park board member who has recently appointed after a lot of, you know, the issues that had happened, appointed by the mayor, he didn't really see anything wrong with this. And so you can see going forward, there might be less animosity.
I'm sure this is the last thing they wanted to get out, especially since they had just signed a huge memorandum of understanding about how this trust money was spent between the city administration, the park board, and the Parks Foundation, which I think was signed the middle part of April, early April. Actually, the park board voted on it on opening day. So I'm sure that that was the last thing that they wanted to see in print.
Oh, you troublemakers, you journalists. I don't know. Jay, you have written this week about the city budget, and it's looming out there. We have a acting city manager. What's happening to the budget right now?
The news is getting worse. In January, when they put together the tentative tax budget that they have to send to the Hamilton County Auditor's Office, they were projecting a deficit of about, I think it was $23.4 million. And this week, that deficit has grown to $29 to $34 million. And because income tax collections are lagging, and apparently they were hoping for some rebound in April, which I'm told there was no rebound. The UC Economic Center is going to have to go back and readjust the revenue forecast for the next fiscal year, and that's why the deficit has increased.
Here's what I'm confused by. Given the job market right now, given pretty much full employment, what's going on here? Why are
we're all looking at each other.
Income tax receipts down. I think this is a really interesting question.
And I'm not going to give the absolute correct answer to this. There's a part of that I believe that involves corporate taxes, and that has been flagging here in the city and also at the state. It's not necessarily individual income taxes. It's something with the way that corporations pay, and that's where the fluctuation has been, I think.
Those records are not public, so they say. You know, because we've heard this before, and I've tried to look at those to see, and certainly we have a lot of interest in our big companies in town. Like, are there issues? What's going on? But they just say, I think it has to do with, like, you know, being publicly traded and, like, things like that, that they don't release that information. But he is right. It definitely has to do with these corporations and what they're paying.
And the interesting thing will be if they can close this without layoffs. They've been able to do that the last several years, but they're running out of sources of revenue to plug that big hole.
Do they have another Blue Ash Airport to sell?
I will say, Harry Black's, I don't know what he wrote, some sort of memo.
He said last week.
He wrote, it was a memo, but in it, when he was talking about the budget, it's the first time I saw there might be layoffs. There could be layoffs. Typically, they can't tell us fast enough that there won't be layoffs. Mm-hmm. And in this case, we've seen them hint at it, and
they have to walk a fine line, too, because they like to brag about a structurally balanced budget. And structurally balanced means that your revenues meet your expenses. Well, obviously, that's not happening. And if they use a lot of one-time sources to plug that, it's not structurally balanced and gets some trouble with the rating agencies.
And correct me if I'm wrong, City Hall reporters, that when you talk about layoffs, you start to talk – I mean, you have to bring up police and fire potentially, right? I mean, those are huge budget parts of the budget.
I think the police and fire make up, is it 66 to 70% of the general fund budget?
Yeah.
But I would, even though the council members aren't going to be on the ballot again for
3 years.
I would say that they're going to be very hesitant to even breathe.
I can't even
police
imagine that.
Well, and then you also, part of the reason why the hole is the Cranley, big Cranley political, you know, union raises that he gave, ahead of the 2017 election. And
I don't see that there should be layoffs in the police and fire department. If I look around City Hall, they're struggling because of how shifts are done. They're struggling to keep the beats staffed. That's a true thing. And we have barely ended brownouts at the fire department with enough employees, and we probably haven't been running enough fire recruit classes. And so, yes, those are like sacred cows and you don't touch them, but it's not like I'm looking at them and being like, why aren't they doing that? I do think that the citizens can be assured that there really doesn't need to be cuts there.
And safety services.
Yes, that would compromise safety in the city.
This is going to, I'm sure, be the subject of future Friday discussions because the budget has to be set by the end of June. So we're now in May,
and
the clock is ticking.
And it's actually delayed because it was supposed to be out either this
May 3rd.
Week.
I have a lot of concerns. They only have a month to do this budget.
Okay.
And the recommended budget is supposed to be out May the 24th.
Okay. Well, I have to take a break now and say goodbye to all three of you, but thank you very much. Concerts are big business that draw big crowds. The Bank's Steering Committee, Cincinnati City Council, and Hamilton County Commission hope a new concert venue on the Central Riverfront will bolster the economic viability of the Banks. The Steering Committee has made a recommendation for a developer, but all the ducks aren't quite in a row yet. To review the prospects of the proposal that has been put forward, we are joined by WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz and WVXU reporter Tana Weingartner. Welcome back to
Hello.
Both of you.
Hello. Gee, thanks for having me.
Gee, on Fridays we get to see all sorts of people. Amanda, why don't we start by just talking about what was sent forward from the steering committee, the recommendation, and what's sort of the who got it and what's the structure here?
Yeah, so the steering committee, which is this group that makes advisory recommendations to the city council and county commission on the Banks, they recommended that the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra be awarded the bid to develop this concert venue that will be along the city's riverfront. And the CSO's bid, the bid is actually for an indoor facility. That's what they'll be building. And then they've offered to manage on what will be a city-owned, potentially park, outdoor events. They're saying up to 20 to 25 a year that will take place in that area as well.
So one of the things, Tana, about this process was that the one person on the steering committee who balked at approving this was former Mayor Charlie Lucan.
Correct.
What are his concerns?
Well, you know, he basically said that it's just going to be more of the same and we need something fresher and newer to kind of come
more
in.
More of the same in what sense? Because
there's
no facility down there.
Well, but the CSO group also is what runs Riverbend and Taft and, of course, Music Hall. So they're already running all of your major sort of music events.
So how will a new facility on the Central Riverfront impact Riverbend? Did they talk about that? Is it different kinds of performances, different kinds of acts? Is the way it will split? Are they competing with each other? What's going on here?
So that wasn't explicitly talked about at all during Wednesday's meeting, I believe it was. but it's sort of this elephant in the room, right? Is that the CSO owns Riverbend. It's something that helps keep them running, the tickets that they sell there. And everyone's very cautious about how a new facility might impact their sales. Now, the CSO's facility that was proposed and then a Columbus-based concert promoter, Promo West, they both proposed smaller venues that a lot of people have said won't necessarily draw the same type of acts and won't cut in too much to the Riverbend business. The Live Nation bid, that was the third bid that was submitted. It's a little bigger, so there's probably some question as to how that would impact Riverbend as well.
And needed some public subsidy, of significant public subsidy in that particular case.
Yes, they submitted this huge bid for a $73 million facility, and they were asking for $37 million. But what was interesting is that we heard a representative from Live Nation who was very frustrated.
Very frustrated.
Yes. And they do this. I mean, they've built tons of concert facilities across the country. So keep in mind, they do this very regularly. He said that had they had an opportunity, like possibly some other people who've been on this project, they would have revised their bid and they might have taken out the public subsidy. They said that they have money to build this facility without that.
Well, that seemed to be one of the questions, both from the bidders who didn't get the recommendation, but also it seemed to be, from what I could tell, a bit of concern from Charlie Lucan that CSO had, maybe because they were Cincinnati-based, they could read the tea leaves over at City Hall. John Cranley made a comment just a day or two before all of this went down that what he expected, mm-hmm. you know, before this, and that CSO could make all these revisions and the other two couldn't.
Right. You know, and they also are more tuned into that, but that doesn't necessarily stop Promo West from paying more attention to government down here. But now, Amanda, you did ask specifically about, was the CSO given that chance to revise their bid that no one else was given? And, I mean, do you want to talk about the answer you got?
Yeah, the attorney at the bank said, no, that's not the case. But there was some serious question. I mean, you saw even Charlie Lucan. He was visibly frustrated by the fact that there was this promotional video that the attorney for the bank's project was showing of the CSO project. At one point, he whispered, "Come on, this is over the top." And then he later said that he was still getting more modifications on the CSO project into his inbox just days before the vote. So I think that's why people. Their bid did seem to change a little bit in response to politicians who were saying they wanted an outdoor facility.
Okay. The steering committee passed along a recommendation for the CSO proposal. Are the other two still in the game? Could City Council and the commission say, you know, we want to talk to all three. We want to give you the chance to revise?
Yeah, as far as I know, they can do whatever they want. It's just a recommendation from the steering committee. The ultimate decision lies with the Hamilton County Commissioners and the Cincinnati City Council. So,
and they all get along really well together.
Of course, so. You know, it's like a big family reunion.
So there could be opportunities here to correct some of these procedural problems.
I should certainly think so, of course.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, you have the bank steering committee is a powerful group already.
Powerful business group.
Yes, you have the owner of the Reds on there who's the chairman, other prominent business leaders. And then in the room that day, there were very powerful people supporting the CSO. So it'll be very interesting to see how the city council and the county commission react to that type of pressure from
How many events were they projecting for this new facility? One of the questions I have in my mind is, you know, how much impact can this really have? You've got – I don't think you're going to run an event at this facility if there's a Reds game or a Bengals game. I mean, the Reds schedule is obviously – there's many, many more games being played. But that's also the good weather when people might want to come down. So how many events could they actually do in a year?
Well, everybody was proposing something a little bit different. You know, Live Nation said they could do 152 events a year, 25 outdoor.
Wow, that's aggressive.
Promo West said they could do 180 per year. And the CSO, I think, said, what, 125?
Yeah, and I thought it was 150 total with the outdoor events, but it could be
right.
Off
and
on
then
that.
Another 20 to 25 with outdoor.
Would they be able
outdoor.
To charge for outdoor events?
I think that's kind of an unknown. And that was something that was actually stressed at the bank steering committee, that this would be more open and it would preserve park space. I would imagine that there are some events that they could charge for and some that they won't charge for.
Right. And Tom Gableman, who you mentioned before, the project council, he kind of said the same to WVXU afterwards. You know, some might be free, some might not be.
But it won't necessarily be free to the taxpayers who have to pay for a park space. It's unclear who will be paying for the temporary stage because the CSO has offered to manage these events, but it's unclear who will pay for all the other things that come along with these events, like I said, a temporary stage and that sort of thing.
Has there been any sort of economic impact study on this and the potential impact on restaurants, bars, on the banks? Because that's really part of this, right, mm-hmm. is to put another feature on the banks that can draw enough people that people don't just walk in, go there, and go home, but they also go to dinner at one of the restaurants,
right.
They go to a bar afterwards, whatever.
Amanda maybe knows more. I don't know that there's been a study, but I know that is one of the things, one of the reasons why they were talking about programming it the way they would, so that they would bring more people into the Banks area during times that are non-peak, the Reds aren't in, the Bengals aren't in, when nothing's really going on there. So to kind of boost that. And that was something that the CSO said would work with their like sort of park light thing. You could walk through and you could get to those areas. And Promo West said, I believe their spokesman kind of said that that's what they tend to draw. Like the people that come to their events are the kind that come early and eat at those places before going to a music venue. You know, they arrive 2 hours early or whatever.
I know the restaurants down there are very concerned about foot traffic and flow and pulling more people consistently across 52 weeks.
Yes, and that's something that politicians have really acknowledged, too, especially because other than GE, there's not this consistent feeder, right, for the restaurants. I mean, you have the stadiums, but those are only, I mean, in the Bengals' case, you're talking about 8 games a year. That's 8 days a year. So they are really wanting something that will consistently bring bring people down there. And when you look at 150 events a year, I mean, that you're talking about half a year. And especially during the winter months, too. That's why an indoor component is also important here.
Right. Being able to shut it off and because it gets cold.
I don't think you want to go to a concert outside on the river in January.
Any timeline, final question, any timeline on when city council and the commission have to move on this?
I haven't heard anything about the city. Now, the county could see the proposal as early as Wednesday, Tom Gableman had said. But I don't know if it'll hit their agenda quite that quick. So probably in May for Hamilton County Commission, at least.
Yeah, and I don't think we'll see anything on the council agenda next week either. So the wheels kind of continue to turn a little slowly.
They'll have to
at the
grind
banks.
A little bit
yes.
more. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Some good news. In the first 4 months of 2018, Cincinnati has experienced a dramatic drop in the number of shootings compared to a year ago. Is this a data blip or a sustainable trend? To answer that, I'm joined by Cincinnati Enquirer breaking news reporter Cameron Knight. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call us at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. We are also on Twitter and Facebook. Cameron, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This is a very interesting development. Talk a little bit just about what it is that statistically has sort of developed here in the first 4 months of 2018.
Right. So we are about a third of the way through the year, and I thought that was a good time to kind of take a look at the data. I'm kind of always watching it, but I took a look at the data. I noticed that in the first 4 months of the year, we had 71 shootings. I compared that to numbers going back all the way to 2008, and we've never, since at least 2008, we've never been that low. In fact, the lowest number prior to that was in 2008 to 2018 period. Was in 2014 when we had 101 shootings that year, and last year we were dramatically higher. We had I think 132 shootings, but that takes into account the Cameo nightclub shooting, which happened last March, which was 17 in one night, basically. Last year we did see an increase in part due to that one big shooting. Basically, we're kind of at a historic low, at least for the last 10 years. We've never seen numbers this low in a decade, basically. And even projecting out, kind of trying to figure out how much shootings in the first third of the year account for, we're projected to have a really low year in shootings just based on prior data.
And when we talk,
obviously things could change.
When you talk about shootings, are you talking about people who have been injured by a gunshot or killed by a gunshot, as opposed to just shots fired type of thing?
Right. So these aren't just shots fired. These are incidents in which there's an injury or a fatality, either one. So we've had so far this year I believe we've had 15 fatal shootings, and that's part of that 71 shootings number. So it accounts for both fatal and non-fatal shootings. But, yeah, it's not just someone going out in the street and firing a gun or even an incident where someone shoots at someone else and no one's injured. These are all incidents where someone was actually hit by a bullet.
Okay. So why the change? Is there, you know, there can be statistical anomalies and from year to year, but this is pretty significant. What do police, what do experts think might be going on here?
Well, so I spoke with Lieutenant Colonel Paul Newdegate. He's our assistant chief for the Cincinnati Police Department. And he credits it to this kind of dramatic fundamental change that police department has had in their policing. They are very, very focused on violent crime, and they're very focused on violent crime perpetrators. And Newdegate said that there are a very, you know, all of their investigations and everything point to this issue where the number of people actually perpetrating shootings in the city is a very small number of people. He uses the number, you know, 60 to 70 people are perpetrating the shootings. So, I mean, in a city with over 400 shootings a year normally, he's implying that this violence is happening. You know, there are repeat offenders, basically, is what he's implying, and that they are trying to go after those people specifically. And they're using technology like ShotSpotter, which is a gun detection network that they installed in Avondale. They're also using a thing called NIBIN, which is basically when a police officer collects a shell casing from a crime scene, they put it in a machine and it basically gets creates a fingerprint, so to speak, of that shell casing. And they're able to connect to know what gun it came from, basically, if it's been used at another crime scene or, they're able to kind of connect where different guns are being used in crimes and if the same gun is being used in multiple crimes. And so there's the technology side of it. And then there's also this shift toward what they call place-based enforcement or place-based policing, where they go into specific neighborhoods. They started in Westwood and East Westwood, and they are kind of starting to phase out of that and shift to Avondale at this point. But there they go in and they look at it block by block. They break it down by even apartment complexes. They look at specific floors and specific apartments within apartment complexes to try and figure out where people feel the most comfortable doing crime and doing violent crime and things like that. And they try to basically make it uncomfortable for them to do that by any number of means. You know, I mean, increased visibility or changing, you know, what a business does or trying to step in and fill vacant buildings up with, businesses that might have a better influence on the neighborhood, all sorts of tactics to kind of make it less comfortable for people to do crime there.
And all of this kind of targeting is in direct sort of contradiction to sort of old time policies of sweeps of the neighborhood, zero tolerance. It's really fundamentally different than what had been happening.
Right. And there are politicians, including John Cranley and some other folks who have said that they're specifically, there was this thing called a vortex unit, which was notorious for doing these super intensive sweeps of over the Rhine in the 90s. And they would go in.
Oh, it's even more recent than that.
So, but specifically in the 90s, some people, including John Cranley, some other people have said that type of enforcement kind of led to what happened in 2001 with Timothy Thomas and his death at the hands of the Cincinnati Police Department and the subsequent civil unrest that we saw after that. So there are some people who've kind of made that connection. But yeah, I mean, it is a fundamental change what they're doing now versus these giant sweeps where they're trying to get the they were still trying to get the people who were doing the bad crimes. It was just instead of laser focusing on that person, they were casting a really, really wide net and hoping to scoop somebody up with a gun or with drugs or something like that.
Well, I want to thank Cameron Knight from the Cincinnati Inquirer. Great story. What clearly we need to do is have you back as you follow this in the next couple of quarters to see if this is sustainable. So thank you, Cameron.
Yeah, thank you. Have a great week.
Okay. I want to now welcome WVXU's new digital editor, Jennifer Merritt, who is here to talk about a new feature that we have just launched on WVXU.org. Jennifer, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you.
And, you know, I said that you're new, but you've been here longer than I have, so what the heck do I know? So what are you doing with the website at this point that is sort of freshened and taken into a new direction?
Yeah, so what we're doing is we're updating more often, like every 2 hours, trying to curate some stories from around Ohio and the area. And we've done a survey to kind of find out to see the areas that the audience feels is missing and wants to see more of.
Okay. And there's also sort of a do list mm-hmm. that you're creating. And this is an interesting weekend to be doing that.
Yeah, we are calling it the WVXU do list. And we decided to do it because we felt like there really was a gap in terms of curated events, specifically around arts. And so what it is, you'll find things like shows by acoustic duos, jazz musicians, orchestras, as well as unique events like swing dances, celebrity book signings, and even things like Everything But the House is having an auction to benefit the Contemporary Arts Center in Blue Ash this weekend. And in addition to that, we'll be doing big things that listeners probably already know about, like Cincy Cinco and the Derby, both happening this weekend. Plus some others that they might not know about, like Free Comic Book Day, which is Saturday.
Oh, Free Comic Book Day. I did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
But also, we have this little thing called the Flying Pig this week.
Right.
And some very practical information mm-hmm. about if you're going to come downtown,
yeah.
how to manage what the streets situation is.
Right.
So where do people find this?
They can find it online. We've also posted it to Facebook as well as Twitter. And the big thing for people to know is that there are actually 3 races happening throughout the weekend. So various streets are closed starting today, actually. And also, Sunday's course has been altered a bit because there's been other events happening around town. So some of these closures that are happening are new.
Okay. Well, I want to thank the WVXU digital editor, Jennifer Merritt, and everybody should be checking that every 2 hours. So we'll see how we go. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.